I can't read glyphs, boy.
Oh, right, Kaladin thought.
Well, if they were glyphs, they weren't ones he was familiar with. Of course, you could draw most glyphs in complex ways that made it hard to read them unless you knew exactly what to look for. There was a figure at the center of the hilt, nicely carved. It was a man in fine armor, shardplate certainly. A symbol was etched behind him, surrounding him, spreading out from his back like wings. Kaladin showed it to Rock, who had walked up to see what he found so fascinating. The Parshendi out here are supposed to be barbarians, Kaladin said, without culture. Where did they get knives like these? I'd swear this is a picture of one of the heralds. Yzereza or Nalan. Rock shrugged. Kaladin sighed and returned the knife to its sheath, then dropped it into his sack. Then they rounded the curve back to the others. The crew had gathered up sacks full of armor, belts, boots, and spears. Each took up a spear to carry back to the ladder, holding them like walking sticks. They'd left one for Kaladin, but he tossed it to Rock. He didn't trust himself to hold one of them again, worried he'd be tempted to fall into another kata. The walk back was uneventful, though with the darkening sky the men began jumping at every sound. Kaladin engaged Rock, Teft, and Dunny in conversation again. He was able to get Drahi and Torfin to talk a little as well. They safely reached the first chasm, much to the relief of his men. Kaladin sent the others up the ladder first, waiting to go up last. Rock waited with him, and as Dunny finally started up, leaving Rock and Kaladin alone, the tall Horn-Eater put a hand on Kaladin's shoulder, speaking in a soft voice.
"You do good work here," Rock said. "I am thinking that in a few weeks, these men will be yours."
Kaladin shook his head. "We're bridgemen, Rock. We don't have a few weeks. If I take that long winning them over, half of us will be dead." Rock frowned.
"Is not a happy thought."
"That's why we have to win over the other men now."
"But how?"
Kaladin looked up at the dangling ladder, shaking as the men climbed up. Only four could go at a time, lest they overload it. "Meet me after we're searched. We're going to the camp market."
"Very well,"
Rock said, swinging onto the ladder as Earless Jax reached the top.
"What will be our purpose in this thing?"
"We're going to try out my secret weapon." Rock laughed as Kaladin held the ladder steady for him.
"And what weapon is this?"
Kaladin smiled. "Actually, it's you." 2 hours later, at Salus's first violet light, Rock and Kaladin walked back into the lumberyard. It was just past sunset, and many of the bridgemen would soon be going to sleep. Not much time, Kaladin thought, gesturing for Rock to carry his burden to a place near the front of Bridge 4's barrack. The large Horn-Eater set his burden down next to Teft and Dunny, who had done as Kaladin had ordered, building a small ring of stones and setting up some stumps of wood from the lumberyard scrap pile. That wood was free for anyone to take. Even bridgemen were allowed. Some liked to take chunks to whittle. Kaladin got out a sphere of light. The thing Rock had been carrying was an old iron cauldron. Even though it was second-hand, it had cost Kaladin a fair chunk of the knobweed sap money. The Horn-Eater began to unpack supplies from inside the cauldron as Kaladin arranged some wood scraps inside the ring of stones. "Dunny, water if you please," Kaladin said, getting out his flint. Dunny ran off to fetch a bucket from one of the rain barrels. Rock finished emptying the cauldron, laying out small packages that had cost another substantial portion of Kaladin's spheres. He had only a handful of clear chips left. As they worked, Hobber limped out of the barrack. He was mending quickly, though the other two wounded that Kaladin had treated were still in bad shape.
"What are you up to, Kaladin?"
Hobber asked, just as Kaladin got a flame started. Kaladin smiled, standing.
"Have a seat."
Hobber did just that. He hadn't lost the near devotion he'd shown Kaladin for saving his life. If anything, his loyalty had grown stronger. Dunny returned with a bucket of water, which he poured into the cauldron. Then he and Teft ran off to get more.
Kaladin built up the flames, and Rock began to hum to himself as he diced tubers and unwrapped some seasonings. In under a half hour, they had a roaring flame and a simmering pot of stew. Teft sat down on one of the stumps, warming his hands.
"This is your secret weapon?"
Kaladin sat down next to the older man.
"Have you known many soldiers in your life, Teft?"
"A few."
"You ever known any who could turn down a warm fire and some stew at the end of a hard day?"
"Well, no. But bridgemen ain't soldiers."
That was true. Kaladin turned to the barrack doorway. Rock and Dunny started up a song together, and Teft began to clap along. Some of the men from other bridge crews were up late, and they gave Kaladin and the others nothing more than scowls. Figures shifted inside the barrack, shadows moving. The door was open, and the sense of Rock's stew grew strong, inviting.
"Come on," Kaladin thought. "Remember why we live. Remember warmth. Remember good food. Remember friends and song and evenings spent around the hearth. You aren't dead yet, storm you. If you don't come out..."
It all suddenly seemed so contrived to Kaladin. The singing was forced, the stew an act of desperation. It was all just an attempt to briefly distract from the pathetic life he had been forced into. A figure moved in the doorway. Scar, short, square-bearded, and keen-eyed, stepped out into the firelight. Kaladin smiled at him. A forced smile. Sometimes that was all one could offer.
"Let it be enough," he prayed, standing up, dipping a wooden bowl into Rock's stew.
Kaladin held the bowl toward Scar. Steam curled from the surface of the brownish liquid.
"Will you join us?" Kaladin asked.
"Please?"
Scar looked at him, then back down at the stew. He laughed, taking the stew.
"I'd join the Night Watcher herself around a fire if there was stew involved."
"Be careful," Teft said. "That's horn-eater stew. Might be snail shells or crab claws floating in it."
"There is not," Rock barked. "It's unfortunate that you have unrefined lowlander tastes, but I prepare the food such as I am ordered by our dear bridge leader."
Kaladin smiled, letting out a deep breath as Scar sat down. Others trailed out after him, taking bowls, sitting. Some stared into the fire, not saying much, but others began to laugh and sing. At one point, Gaz walked past, eyeing them with his single eye as if trying to decide if they were breaking any camp regulations. They weren't. Kaladin had checked. Kaladin dipped out a bowl of stew and held it toward Gaz. The bridge sergeant snorted in derision and stalked away.
"Can't expect too many miracles in one night," Kaladin thought with a sigh, settling back down and trying the stew. It was quite good.
He smiled, joining in the next verse of Dunny's song. The next morning, when Kaladin called for the bridgemen to rise, three-quarters of them piled out of the barrack. Everyone but the loudest complainers, Moash, Sigzil, Narm, and a couple of others. The ones who came to his call looked surprisingly refreshed, despite the long evening spent singing and eating. When he ordered them to join him in practice carrying the bridge, almost all of those who had risen joined him. Not everyone, but enough. He had a feeling that Moash and the others would give in before too long. They'd eaten his stew. Nobody had turned that down. And now that he had so many, the others would feel foolish not joining in. Bridge 4 was his. Now he had to keep them alive long enough for that to mean something.
Decision. For I have never been dedicated to a more important purpose, and the very pillars of the sky will shake with the results of our war here. I ask again, support me. Do not stand aside and let disaster consume more lives. I've never begged you for something before, old friend. I do so now.
Adolin was frightened. He stood beside his father on the staging ground. Dalinar looked weathered.
creases running back from his eyes, furrows in his skin, black hair going white like bleached rock along the sides. How could a man standing in full shard plate, a man who yet retained a warrior's frame despite his age, look fragile? In front of them, two chulls followed their handler, stepping up onto the bridge. The wooden span linked two piles of cut stones, a mock chasm only a few feet deep. The chulls' whip-like antennae twitched, mandibles clacking, fist-sized black eyes glancing about. They pulled a massive siege bridge, rolling on creaking wooden wheels.
"That's much wider than the bridges Sarius uses," Dalinar said to Taleb, who stood beside them.
"It's necessary to accommodate the siege bridge, Bright Lord."
Dalinar nodded absently. Adolin suspected that he was the only one who could see that his father was distressed. Dalinar maintained his usual confident front, his head high, his voice firm when he spoke. Yet those eyes, they were too red, too strained. And when Adolin's father felt strained, he grew cold and businesslike. When he spoke to Taleb, his tone was too controlled. Dalinar Kolin was suddenly a man laboring beneath great weight, and Adolin had helped put him there. The Chulls advanced. Their boulder-like shells were painted blue and yellow, the colors and pattern indicating the island of their reshi handlers. The bridge beneath them groaned ominously as the larger siege bridge rolled onto it. All around the staging area, soldiers turned to look. Even the workmen cutting a latrine into the stony ground on the eastern side stopped to watch. The groans from the bridge grew louder. Then they became sharp cracks. The handlers halted the chulls, glancing toward Taleb.
"It's not going to hold, is it?" Adolin asked.
Taleb sighed.
"Storm it. I was hoping... Bah! We made the smaller bridge too thin when we widened it. But if we make it thicker, it will get too heavy to carry."
He glanced at Dalinar.
"I apologize for wasting your time, Bright Lord. You are correct. This is akin to the 10 Fools.
"Adolin, what do you think?"
Dalinar asked. Adolin frowned.
"Well, I think perhaps we should keep working with it. This is only the first attempt, Taleb. Perhaps there's still a way.
Design the siege bridges to be narrower, maybe."
"That could be very costly, Bright Lord," Taleb said. "If it helps us win one extra gem heart, the effort would be paid for several times over."
"Yes," Taleb said, nodding.
"I will speak with Lady Kalina. Perhaps she can devise a new design."
"Good,"
Dalinar said. He stared at the bridge for an extended moment. Then, oddly, he turned to look toward the other side of the staging area, where the workers had been cutting the latrine ditch.
"Father?"
Adolin asked.
"Why do you suppose," Dalinar said, "there are no shardplate-like suits for workmen?"
"What?"
"Shardplate gives awesome strength, but we rarely use it for anything other than war and slaughter. Why did the Radiants fashion only weapons? Why didn't they make productive tools for use by ordinary men?"
"I don't know," Adolin said.
"Perhaps because war was the most important thing around."
"Perhaps," Dalinar said, voice growing softer. "And perhaps that's a final condemnation of them and their ideals. For all of their lofty claims, they never gave their plate or its secrets to the common people."
I don't understand why that's important, Father."
Dalinar shook himself slightly.
"We should get on with our inspections. Where's Ladent?"
"Here, Bright Lord."
A short man stepped up to Dalinar. Bald and bearded, the Ardent wore thick, blue-gray layered robes from which his hands barely extended. The effect was of a crab who was too small for his shell. It looked terribly hot, but he didn't seem to mind.
"Send a messenger to the 5th Battalion," Dalinar told him. "We'll be visiting them next."
"Yes, Bright Lord."
Adolin and Dalinar began to walk. They'd chosen to wear their shard plate for this day's inspections. That wasn't uncommon. Many shard bearers found any excuse they could to wear plate. Plus, it was good for the men to see their High Prince and his heir in their strength.
They drew attention as they left the staging area and entered the war camp proper. Like Adolin, Dalinar went about unhelmed, though the gorget of his armor was tall and thick, rising like a metal collar up to his chin. He nodded to soldiers who saluted.
Adolin, Dalinar said, in combat, do you feel the thrill?
Adolin started. He knew immediately what his father meant, but he was shocked to hear the words. This wasn't often discussed.
Well, of course. Who doesn't?
Dalinar didn't reply. He had been so reserved lately. Was that pain in his eyes? The way he was before, Adolin thought, deluded but confident, that was actually better. Dalinar said nothing more, and the two of them continued through the camp. 6 years had let the soldiers settle in thoroughly. Barracks were painted with company and squad symbols, and the space between them was outfitted with fire pits, stools, and canvas-shaded dining areas. Adolin's father had forbidden none of this, though he had set guidelines to discourage sloppiness. Dalinar had also approved most requests for families to be brought to the Shattered Plains. The officers already had their wives, of course. A good Light Eyes officer was really a team, the man to command and fight, the woman to read, write, engineer, and manage camp. Adolin smiled, thinking of Malasha. Would she prove to be the one for him? She'd been a little cold to him lately. Of course, there was Danlin. He'd only just met her, but he was intrigued. Regardless, Dalinar had also approved requests by dark-eyed common soldiers to bring their families. He even paid half of the cost. When Adolin had asked why, Dalinar had replied that he didn't feel right forbidding them. The war camps were never attacked anymore, so there was no danger. Adolin suspected that his father felt that since he was living in a luxurious near palace, his men might as well have the comfort of their families. And so it was the children played and ran through the camp. Women hung wash and painted glyph wards as men sharpened spears and polished breastplates. Barrack interiors had been partitioned to create rooms.
I think you were right, Adolin said as they walked, trying to draw his father out of his contemplations.
To let so many bring their families here, I mean.
Yes, but how many will leave when this is over?
Does it matter?
I'm not certain. The Shattered Plains are now a de facto Alethi province. How will this place appear in 100 years? Will those rings of barracks become neighborhoods? The outer shops become markets? The hills to the west become fields for planting?
He shook his head.
The Gemhearts will always be here, it seems. And so long as they are, there will be people here as well.
That's a good thing, isn't it? So long as those people are Alethi, Adolin chuckled.
Perhaps. And what will happen to the value of gemstones if we continue to capture gem hearts at the rate we have?
That was a good question.
What happens, I wonder, when the scarcest yet most desirable substance in the land suddenly becomes commonplace?
There's much going on here, son. Much we haven't considered. The gem hearts, the Parshendi, the death of Gavilar. You will have to be ready to consider these things.
Me? Adolin said. What does that mean?
Dalinar didn't answer, instead nodding as the commander of the 5th Battalion hastened up to them and saluted. Adolin sighed and saluted back. The 21st and 22nd Companies were doing close order drill here, an essential exercise whose true value few outside the military ever appreciated. The 23rd and 24th Companies were doing extended order, or combat drill, practicing the formations and movements used on the battlefield. Fighting on the Shattered Plains was very different from regular warfare, as the Alethi had learned from some embarrassing early losses. The Parshendi were squat, muscular, and had that strange, skin-grown armor of theirs. It didn't cover as fully as plate, but it was far more efficient than what most foot soldiers had. Each Parshendi was essentially an extremely mobile, heavy infantryman. The Parshendi always attacked in pairs, eschewing a regular line of battle. That should have made it easy for a disciplined line to defeat them. But each pair of Parshendi had such momentum and was so well armored that they could break right through a shield wall. Alternatively, their jumping prowess could suddenly deposit entire ranks of Parshendi behind Alethi lines. Beyond all that, there was that distinctive way they moved as a group in combat. They maneuvered with an inexplicable coordination. What it seemed at first to be mere barbarian savagery turned out to disguise something more subtle and dangerous. They'd found only two reliable ways to defeat the Parshendi. The first was to use a shard blade, effective but of limited application. The Kolin army had only two blades, and while shards were incredibly powerful, they needed proper support. An isolated, outnumbered shard-bearer could be tripped and toppled by his adversaries. In fact, the one time Adolin had seen a full shard-bearer fall to a regular soldier, it had happened because he had been swarmed by spearmen who broke his breastplate. Then a light-eyed archer had slain him from 50 paces, winning the shards for himself. Not exactly a heroic end. The other way to fight Parshendi depended on quick-moving formations. Flexibility mixed with discipline. Flexibility to respond to the uncanny way Parshendi fought. Discipline to maintain lines and make up for individual Parshendi strength. Havram, 5th Battalion Lord, waited for Adolin and Dalinar with his company lords in a line. They saluted, right fists to right shoulders, knuckles outward. Dalinar nodded to them.
Have my orders been seen to, Bright Lord Havram?
Yes, High Prince.
Havram was built like a tower, and wore a beard with long sides after the Horn-Eater fashion, chin clean-shaven. He had relatives among the Peak Folk.
The men you wanted are waiting in the audience tent.
What's this? Adolin asked. I'll show you in a moment, Dalinar said. First review the troops. Adolin frowned, but the soldiers were waiting. One company at a time, Havram had the men fall in. Adolin walked before them, inspecting their lines and uniforms. They were neat and orderly, though Adolin knew that some of the soldiers in their army grumbled at the level of polish required of them. He happened to agree with them on that point. At the end of the inspection, he questioned a few random men, asked their rank and if they had any specific concerns. None had any. Were they satisfied or just intimidated? When he was done, Adolin returned to his father.
You did that well, Dalinar said.
All I did was walk down a line.
Yes, but the presentation was good. The men know you care for their needs and they respect you.
He nodded as if to himself.
You've learned well.
I think you're reading too much into a simple inspection, father. Dalinar nodded to Havram, and the battalion lord led the two of them to an audience tent near the side of the practice field. Adolin, puzzled, glanced at his father.
I had Havram gather the soldiers that Sadius spoke to the other day, Dalinar said. The ones he interviewed while we were on our way to the plateau assault.
Ah, Adolin said. We want to know what he asked them.
Yes, Dalinar said.
He gestured for Adolin to enter before him, and they walked in, tailed by a few of Dalinar's ardents. Inside, a group of 10 soldiers waited on benches. They rose and saluted.
At ease, Dalinar said, clasping plated hands behind his back.
Adolin? Dalinar nodded toward the men, indicating that Adolin should take the lead in the questioning. Adolin stifled a sigh. Again?
Men, we need to know what Sadius asked you and how you responded.
Don't worry, Bright Lord,
said one of the men, speaking with a rural northern Alethi accent.
We didn't tell him nothing.
The others nodded vigorously.
He's an eel and we know it, another added.
He's a high prince, Dalinar said sternly. You will treat him with respect.
The soldier paled, then nodded.
What specifically did he ask you? Adolin asked.
He wanted to know our duties in the camp, Bright Lord, the man said. We're grooms, you see.
Each soldier was trained in one or two additional skills beyond those of combat. Having a group of soldiers who could care for horses was useful, as it kept civilians from plateau assaults.
He asked around, said one of the men. Or, well,
His people did. Found out we were in charge of the king's horse during the Chasm Fiend hunt.
But we didn't say nothing, the first soldier repeated. Nothing to get you into trouble, sir. We're not going to give that High Prince, Bright Lord, sir, the rope to hang you, sir.
Adolin closed his eyes. If they had acted this way around Sadeus, it would have been more incriminating than the cut girth itself. He couldn't fault their loyalty, but they acted as if they assumed Dalinar had done something wrong and needed to defend him. He opened his eyes.
I spoke to some of you before, I recall, but let me ask again. Did any of you see a cut strap on the king's saddle?
The men looked at each other, shaking heads.
No, Bright Lord, one of the men replied. If we'd seen it, we'd have changed it, right we would.
But, Bright Lord, one of the men added, there was a lot of confusion that day and a lot of people. Wasn't a right regular plateau assault or nothing like that. And, well, to be honest, sir, who'd have thought that we'd need to protect the king's saddle of all things under the halls?
Dalinar nodded to Adolin, and they stepped out of the tent.
Well, they probably didn't do much to help our cause, Adolin said with a grimace, despite their ardor, or rather because of it.
Agreed, unfortunately.
Dalinar let out a sigh. He waved to Tedet. The short Ardent was standing to the side of the tent.
Interview them separately, Dalinar told him softly. See if you can tease specifics from them. Try to find out the exact words Sadeus used, and what their exact responses were.
Yes, Bright Lord.
Come, Adolin, Dalinar said. We've still got a few inspections to do.
Father, Adolin said, taking Dalinar's arm.
Their armor clinked softly. Dalinar turned to him, frowning, and Adolin made a quick gesture toward the kobold guard. A request for space to speak. The guards moved efficiently and quickly, clearing a private space around the two men.
What is this about, Father? Adolin demanded softly.
What? We're doing inspections and seeing to camp business.
And in each case, you shove me out into the lead, Adolin said. Awkwardly, in a few cases, I might add. What's wrong? What's going on inside that head of yours?
I thought you had a distinct problem with the things going on inside my head.
Adolin winced. Father, I...
No, it's all right, Adolin. I'm just trying to make a difficult decision. It helps me to move about while I do it.
Dalinar grimaced.
Another man might find a place to sit and brood, but that never seems to help me. I've got too much to do.
What is it you're trying to decide? Adolin asked. Perhaps I can help.
You already have. I...
Dalinar cut off, frowning. A small force of soldiers was walking up to the 5th Battalion's practice yards. They were escorting a man in red and brown. Those were Thanadol's colors.
Don't we have a meeting with him this evening?
Adolin asked.
Yes, Dalinar said.
Niter, head of the Kobold Guard, ran to intercept the newcomers. He could be overly suspicious at times, but that wasn't a terrible trait for a bodyguard to have. He returned to Dalinar and Adolin shortly. Tan-faced, Niter bore a black beard cut short. He was a Lighteyes of very low rank, and had been with the guard for years.
He says that High Prince Thanadol will be unable to meet with you today as planned.
Dalinar's expression grew dark.
I will speak to the runner myself.
Reluctantly, Niter waved the spindly fellow forward. He approached and dropped to one knee before Dalinar.
Bright Lord?
This time Dalinar didn't ask for Adolin to take the lead.
Deliver your message. Bright Lord Thanadol regrets that he is unable to attend you this day.
And did he offer another time to meet?
He regrets to say that he has grown too busy, but he would be happy to speak with you at the king's feast one evening.
In public, Adolin thought, where half the men nearby will be eavesdropping while the other half, likely including Thanadol himself, will probably be drunk.
I see, Dalinar said. And did he give any indication of when he'd no longer be so busy?
Bright Lord,
the messenger said, growing uncomfortable. He said that if you pressed, I should explain that he has spoken with several of the other high princes and feels he knows the nature of your inquiry. He said to tell you he does not wish to form an alliance, nor does he have any intention of going on a joint plateau assault with you.
Dalinar's expression grew darker. He dismissed the messenger with a wave, then turned to Adolin. The Cobalt guard still kept a space open around them so they could talk.
Thanador was the last of them, Dalinar said.
Each high prince had turned him down in his own way. Hatham with exceeding politeness, Bathab by letting his wife give the explanation, Thanador with hostile civility.
All of them but Sarius, at least.
I doubt it would be wise to approach him with this, father.
You're probably right.
Dalinar's voice was cold. He was angry, furious even.
They're sending me a message. They've never liked the influence I have over the king, and they're eager to see me fall. They don't want to do something I ask them to, just in case it might help me regain my footing. Father, I'm sorry. Perhaps it's for the best. The important point is that I have failed. I can't get them to work together. Elikar was right. He looked to Adolin. I would like you to continue inspections for me, son. There's something I want to do.
What?
Just some work I see needs to be done.
Adolin wanted to object, but he couldn't think of the words to say. Finally, he sighed and gave a nod.
You'll tell me what this is about, though?
Soon, Dalinar promised.
Very soon.
Dalinar watched his son leave, striding purposefully away. Dalinar's decision was a simple one. Was it time to step aside and let his son take his place? If he took this step, Dalinar would be expected to stay out of politics, retiring to his lands and leaving Adolin to rule. It was a painful decision to contemplate, and he had to be careful not to make it hastily. But if he really was going mad, as everyone in the camp seemed to believe, then he had to step down. And soon, before his condition progressed to the point that he no longer had the presence of mind to let go. A monarch is control, he thought, remembering a passage from the Way of Kings. He provides stability. It is his service and his trade good. If he cannot control himself, then how can he control the lives of men? What merchant worth his stormlight won't partake of the very fruit he sells? Odd that those quotes still came to him, even as he was wondering if they had, in part, driven him to madness.
Niter, he said, fetch my warhammer. Have it waiting for me at the staging field.
Dalinar wanted to be moving, working, as he thought. His guards hastened to keep up as he strode down the pathway between the barracks of Battalions 6 and 7. Niter sent several men to fetch the weapon. His voice sounded strangely excited, as if he thought Dalinar was going to do something impressive. Dalinar doubted he would think it so. He eventually strode out onto the staging field, cape fluttering behind him, plated boots clanking against the stones. He didn't have to wait long for the hammer. It came pulled by two men on a small cart. Sweating, the soldiers heaved it from the cart, the haft as thick as a man's wrist, and the front of the head larger than an outspread palm. Two men together could barely lift it. Dalinar grabbed the hammer with one gauntleted hand, swinging it up to rest on his shoulder. He ignored the soldiers performing exercises on the field, walking to where the group of dirty workers chipped at the latrine ditch. They looked up at him, horrified to see the High Prince himself looming over them in full shard plate.
"Who's in charge here?" Dalinar asked.
A scruffy civilian in brown trousers raised a nervous hand.
"Brightlord, how may we serve you?"
"By relaxing for a little while," Dalinar said. "Out with you."
The worried workers scrambled out. Light-eyed officers gathered behind, confused by Dalinar's actions. Dalinar gripped the haft of his warhammer in a gauntleted hand. The metal shaft was wrapped tightly with leather. Taking a deep breath, he leaped down into the half-finished ditch, lifted the hammer, then swung,
slamming the weapon down against the rock. A powerful crack rang across the practice field, and a wave of shock ran up Dalinar's arms. The shard plate absorbed most of the recoil, and he left a large crack in the stones. He hefted and swung again, this time breaking free a large section of rock. Though it would have been difficult for two or three regular men to lift, Dalinar grabbed it with one hand and tossed it aside. It clattered across the stones. Where were the shards for regular men? Why hadn't the ancients, who were so wise, created anything to help them? As Dalinar continued to work, beats of his hammer throwing chips and dust into the air, he easily did the work of 20 men. Shardplate could be used for so many things to ease the lives of workers and dark eyes across Roshar. It felt good to be working, to be doing something useful. Lately, he felt as if his efforts had been akin to running about in circles. The work helped him think. He was losing his thirst for battle. That worried him, as the thrill, the enjoyment and longing for war, was part of what drove the Alethi as a people. The grandest of masculine arts was to become a great warrior, and the most important calling was to fight. The Almighty himself depended on the Alethi to train themselves in honorable battle, so that when they died they could join the Herald's army and win back the Tranquiline Halls. And yet, thinking about killing was starting to sicken him. It had grown worse since that last bridge assault. What would happen next time he went into battle? He could not lead this way. That was a major reason that abdicating in favor of Adolin looked right. He continued to swing, again and again, beating against the stones. Soldiers gathered above, and despite his orders, the workers did not leave to relax. They watched, dumbfounded, as a shardbearer did their work. Occasionally, he summoned his blade and used it to cut the rock, slicing out sections before returning to the hammer to break them apart. He probably looked ridiculous. He couldn't do the work of all of the laborers in camp, and he had important tasks to fill his time. There was no reason for him to get down in a trench and toil. And yet it felt so good, so wonderful to pitch in directly with the needs of the camp. The results of what he did to protect Elokar were often difficult to gauge. It was fulfilling to be able to do something where his progress was obvious. But even in this, he was acting according to the ideals that had infected him. The book spoke of a king carrying the burdens of his people. It said that those who led were the lowest of men, for they were required to serve everyone. It all swirled around in him. The codes, the teachings of the book, the things the visions, or delusions, showed. Never fight other men except when forced to in war. Bang. Let your actions defend you, not your words. Bang. Expect honor from those you meet, and give them the chance to live up to it. Bang. Rule as you would be ruled. Bang. He stood waist deep in what would eventually be a latrine, his ears filled with the groans of breaking stone. He was coming to believe those ideals. No, he'd already come to believe them. Now he was living them. What would the world be like if all men lived as the book proclaimed? Someone had to start. Someone had to be the model. In this he had a reason not to abdicate. Whether or not he was mad, the way he now did things was better than the way Sadius or the others did them. One need only look at the lives of his soldiers and his people to see that was true. Bang! Stone could not be changed without pounding. Was it the same with a man like him? Was that why everything was so hard for him suddenly? But why him? Dalinar wasn't a philosopher or idealist. He was a soldier. And, if he admitted the truth, in earlier years he'd been a tyrant and a warmonger. Could twilight years spent pretending to follow the precepts of better men erase a lifetime of butchery? He had begun to sweat. The swath he had cut through the ground was as wide as a man was tall, as deep as his chest, and some 30 yards long. The longer he worked, the more people gathered to watch and whisper.
Shardplate was sacred. Was the High Prince really digging a latrine with it? Had the stress affected him that profoundly? Frightened of high storms? Growing cowardly? Refusing to duel or defend himself from slurs? Afraid of fighting? Wishing to give up the war? Suspected of trying to kill the king? Eventually, Teleb decided that letting all the people stare down at Dalinar wasn't respectful, and he ordered the men back to their separate duties. He cleared away the workers, taking Dalinar's order to heart and commanding them to sit in the shade and converse in a light-hearted manner. From someone else, that command might have been said with a smile, but Teleb was as literal as the rocks themselves. Still, Dalinar worked. He knew where the latrine was supposed to end. He'd approved the work order. A long, sloping trough was to be cut, then covered with oiled and tarred boards to seal in the scent. A latrine house would be set at the high end, and the contents could be soul-cast to smoke once every few months. The work felt even better once he was alone. One man, breaking rocks, pounding beat after beat, like the drums the Parshendi had played on that day so long past. Dalinar could feel those beats still, could hear them in his mind, shaking him. "I'm sorry, brother." He had spoken to the Ardents about his visions. They felt that the visions were most likely a product of an overtaxed mind. He had no reason to believe the truth of anything the visions showed him. In following them, he had done more than just ignore Sadius's maneuvers. He'd depleted his resources precariously. His reputation was on the brink of ruin. He was in danger of dragging down the entire Colin house. And that was the most important point in favor of him abdicating. If he continued, his actions could very well lead to the deaths of Adolin, Renarin, and Elokar. He would risk his own life for his ideals, but could he risk the lives of his sons? Chips sprayed, bouncing off his plate. He was beginning to feel worn and tired. The plate didn't do the work for him. It enhanced his strength, so each strike of the hammer was his own. His fingers were growing numb from the repeated vibration of the hammer's haft. He was close to a decision. His mind was calm, clear. He swung the hammer again.
"Wouldn't the blade be more efficient?" asked a dry, feminine voice.
Dalinar froze, the hammer's head resting on broken stone. He turned to see Navani standing beside the trough, wearing a gown of blue and soft red, her gray sprinkled hair reflecting light from a sun that was unexpectedly close to setting. She was attended by two young women, not her own wards, but ones she had borrowed from other light-eyed women in the camp. Navani stood with her arms folded, the sunlight behind her like a halo. Dalinar hesitantly raised an armored forearm to block the light.
"Mathana?" "The rockwork," Navani said, nodding to the trough. "Now I wouldn't presume to make judgments. Hitting things is a masculine art. But are you not in the possession of a sword that can cut through stone as easily as, I once had it described to me, a high storm blows over a Hardassian?"
Dalinar looked back at the rocks. Then he raised his hammer again and slammed it into the stones, making a satisfying crunch.
"Shard blades are too good at cutting." "Curious," she said. "I'll do my best to pretend there was sense in that. As an aside, has it ever struck you that most masculine arts deal with destroying, while feminine arts deal with creation?"
Dalinar swung again. Bang. Remarkable how much easier it was to have a conversation with Navani while not looking directly at her.
"I do use the blade to cut down the sides and middle, but I still have to break up the rocks. Have you ever tried to lift out a chunk of stone that has been sliced by a shard blade?"
"I can't say that I have."
"It's not easy. Bang. Blades make a very thin cut. The rocks still press against one another. It's hard to grasp or move them. Bang. It's more complicated than it seems. Bang. This is the best way."
Navani dusted a few chips of stone from her dress.
and more messy, I see.
Bang.
So, are you going to apologize? She asked.
For
missing our appointment. Dalinar froze in mid-swing. He'd completely forgotten that, at the feast when she'd first returned, he'd agreed to have Navani read for him today. He hadn't told his scribes of the appointment. He turned toward her, chagrined. He'd been angered because Thanadol had canceled their appointment, but at least he had thought to send a messenger. Navani stood with folded arms, safe hand tucked away, sleek dress seeming to burn with sunlight. She bore a hint of a smile on her lips. By standing her up, he'd put himself, by honor, in her power.
"I'm truly sorry," he said. "I've had some difficult things to consider lately, but that doesn't excuse forgetting you."
"I know. I'll ponder a way to let you make up for the lapse. But for now, you should know that one of your span reeds is flashing."
"What? Which one?"
"Your scribes say it is the one bound to my daughter."
"Yasna."
It had been weeks since they'd last communicated. The messages he'd sent her had prompted only the tersest of answers. When Yasna was deeply immersed in one of her projects, she often ignored all else. If she was sending to him now, either she'd discovered something, or she was taking a break to renew her contacts. Dalinar turned to look down the latrine. He'd nearly completed it, and he realized he'd been unconsciously planning to make his final decision once he reached the end. He itched to continue working. But if Yasna wanted to converse, he needed to talk with her. Perhaps he could persuade her to return to the Shattered Plains. He would feel a lot more secure about abdicating if he knew that she would come watch over Elokar and Adolin. Dalinar tossed aside his hammer. His pounding had bent the haft a good 30 degrees and the head was a misshapen lump, and jumped out of the ditch. He'd have a new weapon forged. That was not unusual for shard-bearers.
"Your pardon, Mathana," Dalinar said, "but I fear I must beg your leave so soon after begging your forgiveness. I must receive this communication."
He bowed to her and turned to hurry away. "Actually," Navani said from behind, "I think I'll beg something of you. It has been months since I've spoken with my daughter. I'll join you if you'll permit it." He hesitated, but he couldn't deny her so soon after giving her offense.
"Of course."
He waited as Navani walked to her palanquin and settled herself. The bearers lifted it, and Dalinar struck out again, the bearers and Navani's borrowed wards walking close. "You are a kind man, Dalinar Kolin," Navani said, that same sly smile on her lips as she sat back in the cushioned chair. "I'm afraid that I'm compelled to find you fascinating."
"My sense of honor makes me easy to manipulate," Dalinar said, eyes forward. Dealing with her was not something he needed right now. "I know it does. No need to toy with me, Navani."
She laughed softly. "I'm not trying to take advantage of you, Dalinar. I..." She paused. "Well, perhaps I am taking advantage of you just a little. But I'm not toying with you. This last year in particular, you've begun to be the person the others all claim that they are. Can't you see how intriguing that makes you?"
"I don't do it to be intriguing."
"If you did, it wouldn't work." She leaned toward him. "Do you know why I picked Gavilar instead of you all those years ago?"
"Blast."
Her comments, her presence, were like a goblet of dark wine poured into the middle of his crystal thoughts. The clarity he'd sought in hard labor was quickly vanishing. Did she have to be so forward? He didn't answer the question. Instead, he picked up his pace and hoped that she'd see he didn't want to discuss the topic. It was no use. "I didn't pick him because he would become king, Dalinar, though that's what everyone says. I chose him because you frightened me. that intensity of yours. It scared your brother, too, you know. He said nothing. It's still in there, she said. I can see it in your eyes. But you've wrapped armor around it, a glistening set of shard plate to contain it. That is part of what I find fascinating.
He stopped, looking at her. The palanquin bearers halted.
This would not work, Navani, he said softly.
Wouldn't it?
He shook his head.
I will not dishonor my brother's memory.
He regarded her sternly, and she eventually nodded. When he continued walking, she said nothing, though she did eye him slyly from time to time. Eventually, they reached his personal complex, marked by fluttering blue banners with the glyph pair Hoch and Linnel, the former drawn in the shape of a crown, the second forming a tower. Dalinar's mother had drawn the original design, the same his signet ring bore, though Elokar used a sword and crown instead. The soldiers at the entrance to his complex saluted, and Dalinar waited for Navani to join him before entering. The cavernous interior was lit by infused sapphires. Once they reached his sitting chamber, he was again struck by just how lavish it had gotten over the months. Three of his clerks waited with their attending girls. All six stood up when he entered. Adolin was also there. Dalinar frowned at the youth.
Shouldn't you be seeing to the inspections?
Adolin started. Father, I finished those hours ago.
You did?
Stormfather, how long did I spend pounding on those stones?
Father, Adolin said, stepping up to him, can we speak privately for a moment?
As usual, Adolin's black-peppered blonde hair was an unruly mop. He'd changed from his plate and bathed, and now he wore a fashionable, though battle-worthy uniform with a long blue coat, buttoned at the sides, and straight, stiff brown trousers beneath.
I'm not ready to discuss that as yet, son, Dalinar said softly. I need a little more time.
Adolin studied him, eyes concerned.
He will make a fine high prince, Dalinar thought. He's been reared to it in a way that I never was.
All right, then, Adolin said. But there's something else I want to ask you.
He pointed toward one of the clerks, a woman with auburn hair and only a few strands of black. She was lithe and long-necked, wearing a green dress, her hair arranged high on her head in a complex set of braids held together with four traditional steel hair spikes.
This is Danlin Morikotha, Adolin said softly to Dalinar. She came into camp yesterday to spend a few months with her father, Brightlord Morikotha. She has been calling on me recently, and I took the liberty of offering her a position among your clerks while she is here.
Dalinar blinked.
What about
Malasha? Adolin sighed. Didn't work out.
And this one?
Dalinar asked, voice hushed, yet incredulous.
How long did you say she's been in camp?
Since yesterday?
And you've already got her calling on you?
Adolin shrugged. Well, I do have a reputation to maintain. Dalinar sighed, eyeing Navani, who stood close enough to hear. She pretended, for propriety, that she wasn't listening in.
You know, it is customary to eventually choose just one woman to court.
You're going to need a good wife, son. Perhaps very soon.
When I'm old and boring, perhaps, Adolin said, smiling at the young woman. She was pretty, but only in camp one day?
Blood of my ancestors, Dalinar thought.
He'd spent 3 years courting the woman who'd eventually become his wife. Even if he couldn't remember her face, he did remember how persistently he'd pursued her.
Surely he'd loved her.
All emotion regarding her was gone, wiped from his mind by forces he should never have tempted. Unfortunately, he did remember how much he'd desired Navani, years before meeting the woman who would become his wife.
Stop that, he told himself.
Moments ago, he'd been on the brink of deciding to abdicate his seat as High Prince. It was no time to let Navani distract him.
Brightness Danlin Morikotha, he said to the young woman.
You are welcome among my clerks. I understand that I've received a communication.
Indeed, Bright Lord,
the woman said, curtsying. She nodded to the line of 5 span reeds sitting on his bookshelf, set upright in pen holders. The span reeds looked like ordinary writing reeds, except that each had a small infused ruby affixed. The one on the far right pulsed slowly. Litima was there, and though she had seniority, she nodded for Danlin to fetch the span reed. The young woman hurried to the bookshelf and moved the still-blinking reed to the small writing desk beside the lectern. She carefully clipped a piece of paper onto the writing board and put the ink vial into its hole, twisting it snugly into place, and then pulling the stopper. Light-eyed women were very proficient at working with just their free hand. She sat down, looking up at him, seeming slightly nervous. Dalinar didn't trust her, of course. She could easily be a spy for one of the other High Princes. Unfortunately, there weren't any women in camp he trusted completely, not with Yasna gone.
I am ready, Bright Lord,
Danlin said. She had a breathy, husky voice, just the type that attracted Adolin. He hoped she wasn't as vapid as those he usually picked.
Proceed,
Dalinar said, waving Navani toward one of the room's plush easy chairs. The other clerks sat back down on their bench. Danlin turned the Spanreed's gemstone one notch, indicating that the request had been acknowledged. Then she checked the levels on the sides of the writing board, small vials of oil with bubbles at the center, which allowed her to make the board perfectly flat. Finally, she inked the reed and placed it on the dot at the top left of the page. Holding it upright, she twisted the gemstone setting one more time with her thumb. Then she removed her hand. The reed remained in place, tip against the paper, hovering as if held in a phantom hand. Then it began to write, mimicking the exact movements Yasna made miles away, writing with a reed conjoined to this one. Dalinar stood beside the writing table, armored arms folded. He could see that his proximity made Danlin nervous, but he was too anxious to sit. Yasna had elegant handwriting, of course. Yasna rarely did anything without taking the time to perfect it. Dalinar leaned forward as the familiar yet indecipherable lines appeared on the page in stark violet. Faint wisps of reddish smoke floated up from the gemstone. The pen stopped writing, freezing in place.
Uncle, Danlin read, I presume that you are well.
Indeed, Dalinar replied. I am well cared for by those around me.
The words were code, indicating that he didn't trust, or at least didn't know, everyone listening. Yasna would be careful not to send anything too sensitive. Danlin took the pen and twisted the gemstone, then wrote out the words, sending them across the ocean to Yasna. Was she still in Tukar? After Danlin finished writing, she returned it to the dot at the top left, the spot where the pens were both to be placed so Yasna could continue the conversation. Then turned the gemstone back to the previous setting.
As I expected, I have found my way to Carbranth,
Danlin read.
The secrets I seek are too obscure to be contained even in the Palaneum, but I find hints, tantalizing fragments. Is Elokar well?
Hints? Fragments? Of what? She had a penchant for drama, Yasna did, though she wasn't as flamboyant about it as the king.
Your brother tried very hard to get himself killed by a chasm fiend a few weeks back,
Dalinar replied. Adolin smiled at that, leaning with his shoulder against the bookcase.
But evidently the heralds watch over him. He is well, though your presence here is sorely missed. I'm certain he could use your counsel. He is relying heavily on Brightness Lalai to act as clerk.
Perhaps that would make Yasna return. There was little love lost between herself and Sadius's cousin, who was the king's head scribe in the queen's absence. Danlin scratched away, writing the words. To the side, Navani cleared her throat.
Oh, Dalinar said. Add this. Your mother is here in the war camps again.
A short time later, the pen wrote of its own volition,
Send my mother my respect,
Keep her at arm's length, Uncle. She bites.
From the side, Navani sniffed, and Dalinar realized he hadn't signaled that Navani was actually listening. He blushed as Denlin continued speaking.
I cannot speak of my work via Spanreed, but I'm growing increasingly concerned. There is something here, hidden by the sheer number of accrued pages in the historical record.
Yasna was a Verist Italian. She'd explained it to him once. They were an order of scholars who tried to find the truth in the past. They wished to create unbiased, factual accounts of what had happened in order to extrapolate what to do in the future. He wasn't clear on why they thought themselves different from regular historians.
Will you be returning? Dalinar asked.
I cannot say, Denlin read after the reply came. I do not dare stop my research, but a time may soon come when I dare not stay away either.
What? Dalinar thought.
Regardless, Denlin continued, I have some questions for you. I need you to describe for me again what happened when you met that first Barshendi patrol 7 years ago.
Dalinar frowned. Despite the plate's augmentation, his digging had left him feeling tired. But he didn't dare sit on one of the room's chairs while wearing his plate. He took off one of his gauntlets, though, and ran his hand through his hair. He wasn't fond of this topic, but part of him was glad of the distraction, a reason to hold off on making a decision that would change his life forever. Denlin looked at him, prepared to dictate his words. Why did Yasna want this story again? Hadn't she written an account of these very events in her biography of her father? Well, she would eventually tell him why, and, if her past revelations were any indication, her current project would be of great worth. He wished Elokar had received a measure of his sister's wisdom.
These are painful memories, Yasna. I wish I'd never convinced your father to go on that expedition. If we'd never discovered the Barshendi, then they couldn't have assassinated him. The first meeting happened when we were exploring a forest that wasn't on the maps. This was south of the Shattered Plains, in a valley about 2 weeks' march from the Drying Sea.
During Gavilar's youth, only two things had thrilled him: conquest and hunting. When he hadn't been seeking one, it had been the other. Suggesting the hunt had seemed rational at the time. Gavilar had been acting oddly, losing his thirst for battle. Men had started to say that he was weak. Dalinar had wanted to remind his brother of the good times in their youth. Hence the hunt for a legendary chasm fiend.
Your father wasn't with me when I ran across them, Dalinar continued, thinking back. Camping on humid, forested hills, interrogating Natan natives via translators, looking for scat or broken trees. I was leading scouts up a tributary of the Deathbend River while your father scouted downstream. We found the Barshendi camped on the other side. I didn't believe it at first. Parshmen. Camped. Free and organized. And they carried weapons. Not crude ones, either. Swords. Spears with carved hafts.
He trailed off. Gavilar hadn't believed either when Dalinar told him. There was no such thing as a free Parshmen tribe. They were servants, and always had been servants.
Did they have shard blades, then? Denlin said.
Dalinar hadn't realized that Yasna had made a response.
No.
A scratched reply eventually came.
But they have them now. When did you first see a Barshendi shard-bearer?
After Gavilar's death, Dalinar said.
He made the connection. They'd always wondered why Gavilar had wanted a treaty with the Barshendi. They wouldn't have needed one just to harvest the great shells on the Shattered Plains. The Barshendi hadn't lived on the plains then. Dalinar felt a chill. Could his brother have known that these Barshendi had access to shard blades? Had he made the treaty hoping to get out of them where they'd found the weapons?
Is it his death? Dalinar wondered. Is that the secret Yasna's looking for? She'd never shown Elokar's dedication to vengeance, but she thought differently from her brother. Revenge wouldn't drive her. But questions. Yes, questions would.
"One more thing, Uncle,"
Danlin read.
"Then I can go back to digging through this labyrinth of a library. At times I feel like a cairn robber, sifting through the bones of those long dead. The Parshendi. You once mentioned how quickly they seemed to learn our language."
"Yes," Dalinar said. "In a matter of days we were speaking and communicating quite well. Remarkable. Who would have thought that Parshman, of all people, had the wit for such a marvel? Most he'd known didn't do much speaking at all."
"What were the first things they spoke to you about?"
Danlin said.
"The very first questions they asked. Can you remember?"
Dalinar closed his eyes, remembering days with the Parshendi camped just across the river from them. Gavilar had become fascinated by them. "They wanted to see our maps."
"Did they mention the Voidbringers?"
"Voidbringers? Not that I recall. Why?"
"I'd rather not say right now. However, I want to show you something. Have your scribe get out a new sheet of paper."
Danlin affixed a new page to the writing board. She put the pen to the corner and let go. It rose and began to scratch back and forth in quick, bold strokes. It was a drawing. Dalinar stood up and stepped closer, and Adolin crowded near. Reed and ink wasn't the best medium, and drawing across spans wasn't precise. The pen leaked tiny globs of ink in places it wouldn't have on the other side, and though the inkwell was in the exact same place, allowing Yasna to re-ink both her reed and Dalinar's at the same time, his reed sometimes ran out before the one on the other side. Still, the picture was marvelous.
"This isn't Yasna,"
Dalinar realized. Whoever was doing the drawing was far, far more talented than his niece. The picture resolved into a depiction of a tall shadow looming over some buildings. Hints of a carapace and claws showed in the thin ink lines, and shadows were made by drawing finer lines close together. Danlin set it aside, getting out a third sheet of paper. Dalinar held the drawing up, Adolin at his side. The nightmarish beast in the lines and shadows was faintly familiar. Like...
"It's a chasm fiend,"
Adolin said, pointing. "It's distorted, far more menacing in the face and larger at the shoulders, and I don't see its second set of foreclaws, but someone was obviously trying to draw one of them."
"Yes,"
Dalinar said, rubbing his chin.
"This is a depiction from one of the books here,"
Danlin read.
"My new ward is quite skilled at drawing, and so I had her reproduce it for you. Tell me, does it remind you of anything?"
A new ward, Dalinar thought. It had been years since Yasna had taken one. She always said she didn't have the time. "This picture's of a chasm fiend," Dalinar said. Danlin wrote the words. A moment later the reply came.
"The book describes this as a picture of a void bringer."
Danlin frowned, cocking her head.
"The book is a copy of a text originally written in the years before the Recreants. However, the illustrations are copied from another text, even older. In fact, some think that picture was drawn only two or three generations after the heralds departed."
Adolin whistled softly. That would make it very old indeed. So far as Dalinar understood, they had few pieces of art or writing dating from the Shadow Days, the Way of Kings being one of the oldest and the only complete text. And even it had survived only in translation. They had no copies in the original tongue.
"Before you jump to conclusions,"
Danlin read,
"I'm not implying that the Voidbringers were the same thing as chasm fiends. I believe that the ancient artist didn't know what a Voidbringer looked like, and so she drew the most horrific thing she knew of."
"But how did the original artist know what a chasm fiend looked like?" Dalinar thought.
We only just discovered the shattered plains. But of course, though the unclaimed hills were now empty, they had once been an inhabited kingdom. Someone in the past had known about chasm fiends, known them well enough to draw one and label it a Voidbringer.
I must go now,
Yasna said via Danlin.
Care for my brother in my absence, uncle.
Yasna, Dalinar sent, choosing his words very carefully. Things are difficult here. The storm begins to blow unchecked, and the building shakes and moans. You may soon hear news that shocks you. It would be very nice if you could return and lend your aid. He waited quietly for the reply, the span reed scratching.
I should like to promise a date when I will come.
Dalinar could almost hear Yasna's calm, cool voice.
But I cannot estimate when my research will be completed.
This is very important, Yasna, Dalinar said. Please reconsider.
Be assured, uncle, that I am coming. Eventually. I just can't say when.
Dalinar sighed.
Note, Yasna wrote, that I am most eager to see a chasm fiend for myself.
A dead one, Dalinar said. I have no intention of letting you repeat your brother's experience of a few weeks ago.
Ah,
Yasna sent back.
Dear overprotective Dalinar, one of these years you will have to admit that your favored niece and nephew have grown up.
I'll treat you as adults so long as you act the part, Dalinar said. Come speedily and we'll get you a dead chasm fiend. Take care. They waited to see if a further response came, but the gem stopped blinking. Yasna's transmission complete. Danlin put away the span reed and the board, and Dalinar thanked the clerks for their aid. They withdrew.